Okay, let's continue our newspaper coverage for this Tuesday, and we begin the reading of today's Boston Herald for this 17th of February, 2026. And with that, we say hello to Claire and Mary Ellen.
Welcome, everyone. This is Mary Ellen.
Hello, and we're glad that you're with us. And I'm going to start us off this morning with an article out of Pawtucket, Rhode Island, entitled "Two Killed, Gunman Dead in Rink Shooting." And it is subtitled, "Family Dispute Erupts in Gunfire at High School Hockey Game, Officials Say." Rick Sobey has written this for us. A suspect shot five people at a Rhode Island ice rink Monday afternoon as a, quote, "family dispute," unquote, turned deadly during a high school hockey game. Two victims were killed, and the suspect was dead following the apparent targeted family shooting at Dennis M. Lynch Arena in Pawtucket, according to police. Three other people were shot and were hospitalized in critical condition, Pawtucket Police Chief Tina Goncalves said during a press conference. The police chief confirmed that the shooting stemmed from a, quote, "family dispute," end quote. The suspect, a father of a high schooler, reportedly shot five members of his child's family, according to WPRI. The student's mother and a sibling were killed, the station reported. It appears that the shooter died from a self-inflicted gunshot, Goncalves said. Both victims who died appeared to be adults, the police chief added, but she declined to identify the victims and the shooter. A high school, quote, "senior night," end quote, hockey game was taking place at the rink Monday afternoon. Shaken players and parents were seen outside the arena after the shooting. Pawtucket Mayor Donald Grabian called the incident, quote, "traumatic," unquote. Quote, "it is very tragic," he said at the press conference. And he went on, "you think about it. These are high school kids. They were doing an event. They were playing, you know, with their families, watching a fun time. And it turned into this, so it's got to be traumatic," end quote. On a live stream video of the hockey game, viewers can hear many loud bangs as players duck for cover. Then the players are seen quickly getting off the ice and benches and heading out amid the shooting chaos. The Coventry School District confirmed that all students from the boys' hockey team who were at the arena had been accounted for and were safe. Quote, "all Coventry students have been safely reunited with their loved ones," end quote, Superintendent Donna Cowart wrote, and went on, Don Cowart wrote, "Mental health resources will be made available to the hockey students and families. We encourage anyone who may need support to access these services. Thank you for your cooperation and patience today," end quote. It was senior night for the Blackstone Valley School's cooperative hockey team during a matchup against the Coventry-Johnston cooperative team. FBI Boston agents responded to the scene. Quote, "we stand ready to assist our partners at the Pawtucket Police Department and Rhode Island State Police with any and all resources they need," end quote, FBI Boston posted and went on, quote, "at this time, there is no imminent threat to public safety, and there has been no request for FBI assistance. However, the public should continue to avoid the area. Our prayers are with everyone impacted by this incident," end quote. ATF Boston agents also responded to the scene to help state and local authorities. Providence police said they were, quote, "monitoring the situation in Pawtucket. We currently have officers on scene providing assistance," end quote. Rhode Island Governor Dan McKee said he's, quote, "praying for Pawtucket and everyone involved," end quote. He posted, quote, "we are actively monitoring the shooting at Dennis M. Lynch Arena in Pawtucket. I just spoke with Mayor Grabian, as well as Rhode Island State Police, who are working with local law enforcement," end quote. Rhode Island Congressman Gabe Ammo said, quote, "his thoughts are with the victims of the shooting in Pawtucket at Lynch Arena. I also send comfort to all of the families and spectators who witnessed this horror. I'm saddened that gun violence has impacted another community. An ice arena should be a safe place for kids and families to come together. It's horrible that the memory of these teams' high school hockey senior night with families from across Rhode Island will be a tragedy. I have been in touch with Mayor Grebian and am grateful to bystanders, law enforcement, and first responders who rushed to neutralize this thought, he wrote. And went on, this appears to be a targeted incident, and there is no ongoing danger to the public. I stand ready to help secure any requested federal assistance, end quote. Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey said her, quote, heart is with Pawtucket and the children and families impacted by today's tragic shooting in Rhode Island. Grateful for the quick action of first responders and keeping the victims and their loved ones in my prayers, end quote. The Providence Bruins said the team's, quote, thoughts are with all those affected by the tragic events at the high school hockey game. We share our support with the community and commend the first responders for all their efforts, end quote. This mass shooting comes a couple of months after the deadly mass shooting at Brown University in nearby Providence. In mid-December, Claudio Manuel Neves Valente shot and killed students at Brown University before gunning down an MIT professor in Brookline. Neves Valente shot and killed students Ella Cook and Muhammad Aziz Umerzokov, along with injuring several other students. 2 days later, he gunned down MIT professor Nuno Loureiro at his Brookline home. They were reportedly classmates decades ago in Portugal. After the killing spree, Neves Valente went to a New Hampshire storage facility where he took his own life. That's the end of that sad article. Mary Ellen, what have you got?
Thank you, Claire. We have Gayla Cawley writing this next article under the subsection By the Numbers, entitled High Tax Exodus. Massachusetts loses 182,000 people to other states in the last 5 years, new data finds. And this is Gayla Cawley writing. People are fleeing high-tax Massachusetts at a much higher rate than those moving to the Bay State, resulting in a net domestic out-migration of 182,145 over the past 5 years, according to a new watchdog report. The Pioneer Institute has released a report detailing the state's persistent challenge with losing educated working residents to other states, which it says is, quote, hollowing out Massachusetts' workforce and economy, end quote. Out-migration from April 2020 to July 2025 has been, quote, masked, end quote, but not offset by the influx of international migrants arriving in Massachusetts. From 2022 to 2024, the state took in a net gain of 230,000 of those new immigrants, the report states. Pioneer Institute Executive Director Jim Sturgios said in a statement, quote, the net loss of 182,000 residents to domestic outmigration is like losing 1.5 Cambridges. When you pair that with the loss of private sector jobs, particularly in professional, scientific, and technical fields, it's clear we have serious work to do to reverse a flagging economy, end quote. Massachusetts is one of four states that has yet to recover its pre-2020 private sector employment. Over the same period, the number of workers and firms have grown dramatically in competitor states like Florida, Texas, and North Carolina, the report states. The report flags federal policies from the Trump administration's immigration crackdown as a threat to the state's recent labor force growth, which it says was driven by a net gain in international migrants that softened domestic outmigration. The civilian labor force grew to roughly 3.9 million workers in 2024, which Pioneer said is the largest year-over-year increase since 2018. Aidan Enright, author of, quote, Massachusetts Labor Force, Now and Beyond, end quote, said, quote, the 2024 labor force rebound was the largest single-year increase in several years. But it was driven by a surge in international immigration, with a low birth rate, an aging workforce, and tighter immigration policies. Massachusetts faces serious headwinds ahead, end quote. While the report sounds the alarm on what an immigration slowdown driven by federal policy could do to the Massachusetts labor force and economy, it doesn't really explain why residents are fleeing for other states at such a high rate. But Sturgios, Pioneer's executive director, places the blame on the state's high taxes in an op-ed he co-wrote for the Washington Post that was published on Monday. He says in the op-ed co-written with Christopher Anderson, president of the Massachusetts High Technology Council, quote, census data released last month brought bad news for the high-cost states of Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, Illinois, and California, which all led the nation in net out-migration in 2024. Taxpayers fled these high-tax states and piled into low-cost, low-tax states such as Texas, Florida, and North Carolina, where they can keep more of their money and, in many cases, retire their shovels, end quote, Sturgios and Anderson wrote. In October, the Tax Foundation's 2026 State Tax Competitiveness Index ranked Massachusetts 43rd overall. Sturgios and Anderson wrote that while a decade ago the Massachusetts economy was growing to as high as 3.7% above the national average in 2016, quote, high taxes, coupled with rapidly growing state spending, have eroded the state's competitiveness. Since 2018, the state budget has increased by more than 50%, far outpacing inflation or family income growth, Sturgis and Anderson wrote and went on. While a majority of states cut taxes after the pandemic, Massachusetts voters narrowly approved a 9% income tax rate on annual earnings over $1 million in 2022. And went on, now the state is losing residents to more affordable states like New Hampshire and Florida. In 2024, net out-migration was more than seven times larger than in 2010. From 2021 to 2024, more than 790,000 residents in total left Massachusetts, more than the entire population of Boston. Even accounting for people who moved in, the state still lost 164,000 residents, end quote, the op-ed states. Many of the residents leaving drive the state's economy, such as families, recent graduates, and mid-career workers, leading to what Sturgios and Anderson call a, quote, brain drain, end quote, of, quote, talented workers, end quote, that could further hamper competitiveness. Sturgios and Anderson made a pitch for Massachusetts voters to approve a potential ballot question this fall that would cut the state's income tax from 5% to 4%, which they said would save taxpayers an average of $1,300 per year. Governor Mara Healey came out against the income tax cut in an interview with WCVB's On the Record that aired on Sunday. Healey said that if the ballot question were to be approved, it would result in a, quote, huge cut, end quote, to the state budget that would effectively eliminate 65% of funding for education and significantly reduce state funding for cities and towns. Healey said, quote, it's going to be very, very harmful, and that's why it doesn't make sense. All the free school meals, the free community college, making financial aid larger for people in Massachusetts, all of these things are going to go away. That doesn't make Massachusetts more affordable, end quote. And that was Gayla Cawley on that issue. Claire?
Thank you. Under commentary, we have an article written by Joe Battenfeld, one of the columnists, and he entitles it, Why Democrats Hate Voter ID Laws. Democrats are promising to kill a bill requiring voters nationwide to show an ID at the polls, part of a long campaign to keep the election laws loose and make it easier for Democrat-leaning voters to cast ballots. So why are they so worried about what seems like a common-sense measure to prevent fraud? The bill, narrowly passed by the House and now before the U.S. Senate, would crack down on illegal voting in 14 states, including Massachusetts, that do not force voters to show a photo ID. It would also require proof of citizenship to register to vote. The proposed law change could have wide-ranging ramifications for the midterm and presidential elections, which are ripe for fraud. Democrats claim the bill is too stringent and would discourage legal citizens from voting and even prevent married women who change their names from casting ballots. These scare tactics are likely to work in the Senate, where supporters of the bill, called the Save America Act, need 60 votes to send it to President Donald Trump. That's a threshold Republicans can't meet, and Democrats have in fact called the bill, quote, dead on arrival, end quote. Massachusetts is especially susceptible to fraud because the state has handed out tens of thousands of driver's licenses to illegal immigrants, giving them a handy photo ID. In some cases, Bay State voters may be asked for identification, which could be a driver's license or simply a recent utility bill or letter from a school housing office. Even if they don't produce one of those documents, voters can still cast a provisional ballot, giving them time to find an acceptable form of ID. Some states are even more lenient, requiring voters to simply swear they are citizens or signing a poll book to cast a ballot. Trump recently vowed to take executive action if the Save America Act fails, circumventing Congress. But that will face tough legal challenges. Quote, there may be voter ID for the midterm elections, whether approved by Congress or not, end quote, Trump posted. Not likely. The courts are almost sure to rule Trump's action unconstitutional. But the back-and-forth debate shows how critical it would be to change the election laws. Republicans have for years claimed widespread fraud at the ballot box, while Democrats say it is rare and overstated. So why not require a simple photo ID to vote, just like you do to buy a six-pack of beer? If Democrats claim non-citizens hardly ever vote, why not put it to the test? Because they know the bill could jeopardize their voter outreach efforts and kill liberal election laws in some states, like same-day registration, which favor Democrats. It's a high-stakes fight that probably won't be settled before the midterms. And that is Joe Battenfeld's thinking for the day. Mary Ellen.
Oh, thank you, Claire. Under the subsection Criminal Justice, Colleen Cronin is writing the next article entitled Waiting to be Heard. Man who says he was wrongfully convicted in the 1984 murder awaits clemency hearing. After 45 years in prison and 7 failed attempts to appeal his 1981 first-degree murder conviction, James Rodwell thought that the clemency hearing he'd been granted last April might mean a chance to be free. According to Governor Mara Healey's clemency guidelines, hearings should be held and recommendations should be issued within 6 months of filing a petition under most circumstances. But 10 months after learning he would get a chance to plead his case, and more than a year after filing the original petition, Rodwell, now a 70-year-old man with a heart condition, has not received a hearing date. Rodwell is serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole for the 1979 murder of Louis Rose Jr., the 21-year-old son of a Burlington police captain in Somerville. Even after the conviction, Rodwell has maintained his innocence, citing a lack of physical evidence in the case and credibility of the prosecution's 2 star witnesses. Frankie Holmes received immunity for his testimony, while David Nagel, who said Rodwell confessed to him in prison, was a paid federal informant, according to evidence revealed by his current lawyer, something omitted at trial. The Middlesex District Attorney's Office has said that it is not taking a position on Rodwell's clemency petition, although it noted in a letter to the Advisory Board of Pardons that Rose's brother, quote, still lives with the trauma of his brother's murder. He feels the sentence was appropriate and that he is opposed to release for the petitioner, end quote. According to executive clemency guidelines, the board has 6 months to hold a clemency hearing and issue recommendation from the time a petition is filed, quote, unless additional evidence from the petitioner is necessary to make the recommendation, end quote. Rodwell's lawyer, Veronica White, said they filed their petition in November of 2024, over a year ago, and that she has, quote, been at the government's disposal, end quote. Elaine Driscoll, a spokesperson for the Executive Office of Public Safety and Security, told the Herald that clemency hearings are just one of several types of proceedings on the parole board calendar, quote, which also includes a range of statutorily required hearings and other matters that come before the board. The board is working to schedule hearings as expeditiously as possible while balancing all required matters and ensuring appropriate time for review and preparation, end quote, she wrote. Asked why Rodwell's hearing has been delayed, Driscoll said she couldn't provide any more information. Rodwell has only been able to request clemency because of a change to the clemency guidelines that opened up the process to people who maintain their innocence. White told the Herald, quote, I applaud the governor's office for invoking these new rules and regulations, which hopefully can provide the pathway to Jimmy's freedom, which is long, long overdue. He's got a heart condition. He's 70 years old. His health is declining, end quote. In a statement made through White, Rodwell pointed to the clemency guidelines, which say they can be a, quote, means of addressing unfairness in the criminal justice system, end quote, to explain why he should be issued clemency. The case, quote, epitomizes a grave miscarriage of justice that has gone on for 45 years, Rodwell Rodwell said, and he went on, quote, the governor has a duty to finally correct this egregious misconduct, end quote. While they await a hearing date, Rodwell's sister, Kimberly Pasciuto, has been getting ready for his potential release. The siblings have gone through this process many times before. When they thought Rodwell would be able to spend time with his parents in their golden years, when they saved a seat for him at his niece's wedding, Rodwell's mother and father have since passed and his niece got married. They had been especially hopeful when Rodwell was granted an evidentiary hearing for his seventh appeal, but it wasn't successful. Pasciuto said, quote, we all thought he was coming home with us that day. Both my parents were still here. It was the last time he saw them both together, end quote. Her son, Mikey, was the one who later had to help Rodwell join his mother's funeral through Zoom. Mikey said, quote, I actually had to hold the laptop as he saw my grandmother's casket, end quote. While talking to the Herald about the case in their Burlington home, Rodwell called. He said hello, asked how everyone was doing, and thanked the Herald photographer and reporter who'd driven, after a snowstorm, to make the in-person interview. Rodwell said he'd call back later. The siblings talk multiple times a day. Mikey said, after they hung up the phone, quote, and it used to be collect, so God knows how much Nani and Papa used to pay, end quote. Their relationship with Rodwell consists of these daily calls and visits to the North Central Correctional Institution in Gardner, where Rodwell is imprisoned. They hear about Rodwell's life behind bars, the work he does with younger prisoners, and his ping pong game, which Mikey hopes to challenge if he comes home. The limbo they're in can be frustrating, they said, but at every obstacle they try to keep moving forward. And through it all, Kim said they have gotten very good at waiting. And that was Colleen Cronin writing about that story. Clear?
We'll move now to an article written by Rick Sobey entitled A Huge Victory for Student Free Speech. And this is subheaded On Campus and subtitled Judge Finds UMass Amherst Likely Violated Students' Rights with Suspension After Pro-Palestinian Protest. UMass Amherst likely violated a student's First Amendment rights when the campus suspended the pro-Palestine protester for a year, a judge has ruled. The school was ordered to lift the suspension for the student and let him return to campus while his lawsuit moves forward. The third-year student, Kivligan de Montebello, last fall helped organize a protest by Students for Justice in Palestine against Raytheon's participation in a career fair held by the Eisenberg School of Management in the campus center. University officials ended up ruling that Montebello, during the protest, violated three policies in the Code of Student Conduct, which were creating disturbance, disruptive behavior, and failure to comply. Taking into account his prior conduct code violations, the school imposed a year-long suspension until December 31, 2026. But now, a Hampshire Superior Court judge has ruled in favor of Montebello and ordered UMass Amherst to terminate the suspension. Quote, after oral argument on February 11, 2026, and review of the parties' submissions, the court concludes, based on the record presently before the court, that plaintiff has met the standard for a preliminary injunction with regard to his claim that the suspension violates his right to free speech under the First Amendment and Article 16 of the Declaration of Rights, end quote, Justice Jeffrey Trebani wrote in the ruling. The judge granted Montebello's emergency motion for a temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction. While this case continues, the judge said UMass Amherst is banned from dismissing Montebello, preventing him from taking classes, or otherwise fulfilling academic requirements, and further sanctioning the student. This is a huge, quote, this is a huge victory for student free speech, end quote, said Ursula Masny-Latos, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild Mass Chapter. And she went on, the court confirmed what we argued from the start. UMass cannot suspend a student for exercising his constitutional right to peaceful protest. Universities that silence dissent should take notice, end quote. As the protesters last fall marched to the campus center, Montebello used a bullhorn to engage in a call and response with other protesters. Then, before the group entered the center, school officials told Montebello to not use amplified sound in the building. The protesters continued into the campus center to the registration area. There, a university official, Associate Vice Chancellor Jeff Hessek, told protesters to stop using the bullhorn and to limit their physical presence to a marked area next to the registration area. Although protesters moved to the designated area, they continued to chant, and the university staff closed the doors to the auditorium where Career Day was taking place. Hescock again told protesters to stop using the bullhorn, and the group stopped chanting. Montebello walked around and spoke with students who were checking into the career fair. He then again began leading protesters in a call-and-response chant. Hescock directed the protesters to leave. In all, students from SJP spent about 2 hours at the campus center. UMass Amherst submitted several videos of the protest. Although Hescock described the chants as, at one point, quote, loud yelling and screaming, end quote, he noted that, quote, there were no disruptions inside the campus center auditorium and the event proceeded as planned, end quote. When the university hearing board ruled that Montebello violated policies, the board said, Kiv acknowledged leading the protesters in call-and-response style chants in the immediate vicinity of the career fair, which could be clearly heard inside the space where student attendees were meeting with prospective employers, end quote. Kiv Ligon did not immediately comply with the directive given by members of the DRST, or the Demonstration Response and Safety Team, to cease leading the group in call-and-response style chants conducted at loud volume within the building, the board added. A student can be punished if their conduct causes a substantial disruption, according to the Hampshire Superior Court judge. Quote, considering the evidence submitted by the parties, the court concludes that the plaintiff will likely succeed on the merits of his First Amendment claim, end quote, the judge wrote in the ruling, and went on, Hescock's statement that quote, there were no disruptions inside the campus center auditorium and the event proceeded as planned, end quote, is particularly helpful to plaintiff's case as a contemporaneous assessment by the university of the impact of the protest on the career fair. Unquote. The protesters' chants being heard at the career fair, quote, does not describe a substantial disruption of that event, end quote, the judge added. Montebello was also arguing that he'd suffer, quote, irreparable harm, end quote, from the suspension. The judge agreed. He said, quote, the university appears to argue that issuance of a preliminary injunction to allow plaintiff to attend the university during the pendency of this litigation could, quote, disrupt all of the university's day-to-day business, end quote, by causing repeat protests involving loud indoor chanting, end quote, the judge wrote. He went on, quote, the university's prediction is speculative. The risk of harm to plaintiff from the gap in his educational record that the suspension would surely create outweighs any risk of harm to the university should he be permitted to attend the university during the pendency of this litigation. End quote. The Herald reached out to UMass Amherst about the ruling. A UMass Amherst spokesperson said in a statement, quote, "While the university, as always, respects the outcome of judicial process, it will not comment on active litigation." End quote, and end of the article. Mary Ellen.
Oh, thank you, Claire. What do you think? At 35 minutes past the hour, shall we turn to the opinion and editorial pages?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
We have two editorials. The first one in the Herald today is entitled Fight Fraud, Audit Snap. If one food stamp recipient had to leave their groceries behind at the checkout counter due to fraud, that's one time too many. If that mother or father had to turn to their children and say, quote, "Sorry, kids, we need to put it all back," end quote, that's unacceptable. That's why the Herald is calling on Governor Mara Healey to order the State Department of Transitional Assistance, or DTA, to immediately open up all its books for a federal audit by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. After the Herald's Sunday expose on alleged, quote, rampant and unabated, quote, fraud and abuse of taxpayer-paid SNAP benefits, there's no time to waste. Yes, fraud may not be overwhelming, as the DTA argues, but try being that hungry mom in the grocery aisle. In her favor to thwart ICE agents and score political brownie points, the governor is failing to do her job. Legitimate food stamp recipients need someone to defend their right to feed their families. Hard times can befall anyone unexpectedly, but knowing your EBT card won't fail should be the least you can expect. The White House has called on Healey to provide the USDA with information on SNAP recipients to allow them to root out waste, fraud, and abuse, accusing the governor of protecting fraudsters over constituents. Why is Healey doing this? In our polarized political climate, it's safer for any Democrat to follow the script instead of working with the federal authorities in power to guarantee SNAP benefits reach the right people. In turn, objecting to other aspects of an administration may actually carry more weight, but that's our flawed political system where the truth is always the first victim. If the state's Democratic delegation had yelled in unison at the Biden administration for failing to control the porous immigration system, we wouldn't be in this predicament. The Herald has pointed out before that SNAP benefits make no sense. Welfare recipients can't use ATMs in casinos and pot shops. But that didn't stop them from firing up EBT cards in Hawaii, the Virgin Islands, California, Florida, and Alaska. Yes, aloha food stamps. We added in that July 2024 story that taxpayer-paid, quote, economic assistance, end quote, for Massachusetts residents cropped up from Alabama to Arizona, Pennsylvania to Puerto Rico, Utah to Wyoming, and all the New England states. It's all part of the $3 billion federal and state dollars given out in fiscal year 2024. Many worry that the migrant crisis will only exacerbate this staggering bill. It's sad to say we are right. This Sunday's story stressed that a whistleblower credits the sharp rise in fraud to unfettered illegal immigration during the Biden administration. State Senator Ryan Fatman A Sutton Republican, told us in 2024, quote, "What the hell is someone doing in Hawaii? We need this money to help families. This tells me there's a major problem with this system," end quote. He's convinced new arrivals grab welfare handouts here and then bolt, or as we just reported, they rip off the system. Again, even one example is too many. It's time to let the USDA do its job, or just watch as U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts Leah Foley does hers and tracks down greedy food stamp goons. And that was one of the editorials. Joe Dwinell is writing the next one under subsection Heart of the Matter, and it's entitled Appreciation, A Life Dedicated to the Truth. There's a symbiotic relationship between the two worlds of public relations and journalism. Both connect where the story begins. Sure, people in trouble or those in need of some good press hire a good PR firm. Those overwhelmed by the media also turn to those professionals. The best in the business, and you can easily spot them as they're coming at you, compel you to listen to their point of view. It's a skill to both enlighten and work for a client. Catherine Bloom, that's K-A-T-H-R-Y-N-B-L-O-O-M, Catherine Bloom, was among that rare breed. She was a newcomer to Boston when she took a job as Director of Communications for Biogen, Inc. in Cambridge in 1991. She entered her career there as Senior Director of Public Affairs, which included establishing and then running Biogen's corporate foundation, a Northeastern University profile tells. Biogen is a Massachusetts success story, but she retired to pursue her PhD in English from Northeastern. She died last week, but her work will not be forgotten. Fellow public relations pro George Regan said, quote, "We all should be fortunate to have someone to call our best friend. I can proudly say that Catherine Bloom was that person in my life. Catherine was there when I opened the doors to Regan Communications over 40 years ago. Her deep intellect, professionalism, and deep understanding of the media landscape helped propel their company, this company, to where it is today," end quote, Regan added. Not only was Bloom a spokesperson for Biogen, but she also wrote fiction and literary criticism and supported Jewish causes around the globe. Regan added, quote, "Her cup was always half full, even when faced with a life-threatening cancer diagnosis in 2025. She did not sulk or surrender to defeat. Instead, she added to her to-do list and continued to live her life on her terms with grace and compassion for others. Sadly, my best friend passed away earlier this week. While I am heartbroken over this deep loss, I remain grateful to have known this amazing person and eternally thankful to have shared countless laughs, reflective conversations, and memories with her that I will forever cherish," end quote. Bloom wrote for the Times of Israel last year that there's, quote, "nothing like a cancer diagnosis to focus your mind on updating your will," end quote. It was a prompt to wrestle with leaving money to a college, quote, "that on some level tolerates anti-Semitism, or do I support the aspects of its mission that will help save lives," end quote, with its nursing program. Forever the PR pro, forever illuminating while being honest about a story. It was her story this time, wrapped in the struggle to balance Israel's right to exist. There's no easy answer, and that's a message worth sharing. And she included her school in that will, ending her essay with, quote, In the end, I included my university in my will. The majority of my bequests are still to Jewish organizations, but I am an American, and it is important to me to support my country, the country that gave hope and safety to my grandparents. End quote. And that was Joe Dwinell. Click.
Thank you. Under opinion, John Deaton has written an article entitled Snap Fraud is a Gut-Wrenching Betrayal. John Deaton, by the way, is a Republican candidate for U.S. Senate in Massachusetts. He is a U.S. Marine and is the lead plaintiff in the case Deaton et al. Versus Clerk of the House. And this is his thinking for today. I didn't just read Sunday's Boston Herald expose on, quote, rampant, end quote, snap fraud as a taxpayer or a candidate for U.S. Senate. I read it as a kid who grew up on food stamps. I know what it feels like to rely on that card to eat. I know the thin line between a full stomach and a hungry night. When a whistleblower reveals that fraud rings, quote, steal unabated, end quote, millions in benefits, spending funds out of state while legitimate recipients find their cards empty, it isn't just a, quote, budget leak, end quote. It is a gut-wrenching betrayal of the most vulnerable children in our Commonwealth. Fraud doesn't just steal from taxpayers. It steals from the kid I used to be. It starves the very families the program was designed to help. The whistleblower's details are damning. Managers pressure staff to, quote, tread lightly, end quote, on vetting. Leadership downplays $12 million in uncovered fraud. And unchecked illegal immigration fuels a surge in abuse of the system. Yet, while the Department of Transitional Assistance claims fraud is, quote, rare, unquote, officials refuse to share data with the USDA. This culture of secrecy starts at the top. Attorney General Andrea Campbell calls the effort to audit the legislature a, quote, ploy, unquote. Yet she stands by while officials block the state's own auditor. This isn't about, quote, separation of powers. Unquote. It's about leaders refusing accountability for a system they have clearly broken. That is why 28 fellow taxpayers and I filed a lawsuit last week to enforce the 72% voter mandate for a legislative audit. We also call for a, quote, DAT squeeze, end quote, which is the DAT stands for Democratic Accountability and Transparency Squeeze. A targeted federal freeze on non-essential, non-emergency, discretionary state grants until Beacon Hill stops spending public money on private lawyers to block transparency and opens the books. We have carefully shielded essential funding such as SNAP and Medicaid from this freeze. Our goal is to protect the program, not punish the poor. But we cannot protect what officials refuse to show us. Beacon Hill's obstruction enables scammers and hurts the needy. It's time to stop the rallies, stop the excuses, and honor democracy by allowing the audit. Taxpayers and the kids who rely on SNAP both deserve a system that works for them, not for fraud rings. And that is John Deaton's thinking for today. And a further article entitled Reader's Corner. And the author of this article is David Kornwitz, and he is chair of the Wellesley Retirement Board. The article is entitled Healthcare Costs Don't Need to Bury Budgets. Everyone, families, employers, and governments alike, is facing rising health care costs. While no single policy can solve health care inflation broadly, House Bill 1399, in parentheses H, period, 1399, currently before the Massachusetts House Ways and Means Committee, offers a targeted and practical opportunity to address affordability for one group in particular, Medicare-eligible municipal retirees whose health care costs are not only rising faster than inflation, but faster than municipal revenues. H1399 provides municipalities with a voluntary opportunity to modernize retiree health care by pairing employer-funded health, and these are in capital letters, health reimbursement arrangements, employer-funded health reimbursement arrangements, which are called HRAs, with individual Medicare coverage. This approach has been used successfully nationwide for nearly two decades and already serves more than 50 million Medicare beneficiaries, including hundreds of thousands in Massachusetts. Importantly, H1399 does not mandate any change. It simply allows municipalities to consider this option, and it should only be pursued if an actuarial analysis demonstrates with 99.99% confidence, as actuaries never say 100%, that retirees would be equal or better off than under the existing group plan. Once an HRA funding level is established, the structure ensures benefits do not erode over time, as funding is adjusted annually for medical inflation. For Medicare-eligible retirees, the potential benefits are substantial. A representative retiree could obtain the most comprehensive Medicare supplement coverage available in Massachusetts. No networks, no prior authorizations, and near first dollar coverage, along with a robust Medicare Part D plan for roughly $275 per month in 2026. Comparable municipal group retiree plans now cost well over $500 per month and continue to rise more rapidly. Because Massachusetts law already requires municipalities to subsidize at least 50% of retiree health care premiums, retirees in towns like Wellesley that provide a 50% subsidy could see average savings of approximately $4,000 per retiree per year, or about $8,000 for a retiree and spouse, without any reduction in benefits. Municipalities benefit as well, not only because their share of premiums is lower, but more importantly, through a reduction in long-term health care liabilities. OPEB liabilities, which represent retiree health care obligations for both current retirees and active employees, typically decline by 20 to 30% under this model. Lower liabilities improve long-term fiscal sustainability and makes it easier for communities to fund capital projects and more. Some advocacy groups oppose H1399, but doing so effectively prevents municipalities from even evaluating this opportunity, while simultaneously denying Medicare-eligible retirees access to equal or better benefits at substantially lower cost. Maintaining the status quo is not a neutral position. It virtually guarantees growing fiscal strain and diminished flexibility over time. H1399 is not a mandate. It is not a benefit cut. It is a measured, responsible option that deserves serious consideration. Municipal retirees, local officials, and taxpayers who care about long-term affordability and fiscal stability should respectfully encourage their state legislators to allow cities, towns, and the Commonwealth the opportunity to evaluate H1399 on its merits. Thoughtful consideration, not obstruction, is what responsible government requires. And by the way, folks, that is the end of David Cornwitz's thinking for today. And the article, which is entitled Reader's Corner, is said underneath, share your opinions at, quote, letters to editor at bostonherald.com. And that is the end of that one. Mary Ellen.
Thank you, Claire, for that. Reader's Corner.
Yeah.
Colleen Cronin is writing, reporting on the police blotter. Man arrested on rape and child porn charges. Suspect is expected to be arraigned at BMC Roxbury. Police arrested a Boston man for allegedly sexually assaulting a minor and creating and disseminating child pornography on Friday. Talik Rashan Garcia, age 36, was arrested following a search warrant at an apartment on Peterborough Street, executed by officers from the police and Mass State Police, Boston Police Department said in a statement. Garcia was charged with rape and abuse of child, aggravated by a 10-year age difference, trafficking of persons for sexual service under the age of 18, posing or exhibiting a child in a state of nudity or sexual conduct, dissemination of that kind of material, as well as knowing purchase or possession of a visual material of a child depicted in sexual conduct. The suspect is expected to be arraigned at Boston Municipal Court in Roxbury on Tuesday. Injured state trooper is released from the hospital. A Mass State Police trooper who was injured in a crash on Saturday in Salisbury has been released from the hospital, according to a Massachusetts State Police spokesperson. The trooper was hit after pulling over on I-95 South to move a ladder that was in the travel lane. When the trooper got back into his vehicle, he was hit by another car. The driver of the other car, Joshua Levi Cuevas Santana, age 24, of Lawrence, faces criminal charges, including negligent operation, speeding, using a mobile device while driving, and failure to move over for an emergency vehicle. And our time for reading of the Boston Herald has come to an end. Thank you for listening. This is Mary Ellen.
And this is Claire. We hope you have a good day. Take care. Bye-bye.